from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
We have a special program for you tonight. We begin, though, with the breaking news on the criminal probe swirling around Donald Trump. Late today, a new win for the Atlanta DA investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the election results there in Georgia. You may remember there was an escalation request. Well, county judges are approving it. So DA Willis's request to seat a special grand jury is green lit. It will be focused on evidence in that Trump probe. It can be used to compel witness testimony. And the special grand jury may make recommendations concerning criminal prosecution. That's what makes it such a potentially legally serious move. It's why, famously, Bob Mueller always worked through the grand jury system. All of this comes as a Trump aide admits involvement in a plot to put forward fraudulent or alternative electors. That happened here on MSNBC on The Beat. And we have more on that ahead, including my special breakdown, dealing with, in some ways, some of the questions I've heard from Beat viewers and others about what happened on Friday. But the top story right now is President Biden dealing with these world threats on multiple fronts. A political opposition that is brazen about its lack of an agenda other than saying it will obstruct or even try to jail the opposition party. I'll explain, but also we have these fears that are very real over Russia invading Ukraine. Biden putting 8,500 troops on high alert for any possible deployments. If it comes to that, the State Department evacuating staff from Ukraine, which is one sign of what they are worried about. And against this backdrop, you have the kind of thing that reminds you that the presidency is a full-time and unpredictable job because a lot of people are worried about markets and inflation and on Wall Street. A wild day, stocks dropping before then, staging a kind of a late comeback and closing actually up. But many do not like the unpredictability. Biden also meeting with advisors on one of the major factors shaking up investors and families across the country, the related issue of inflation. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is rolling out 400 million new and free N95 masks this week to deal with COVID. Dr. Fauci says the Omicron wave is going in the right direction. And we are looking at what you see here is the concrete challenges of governing in a political environment where top Republicans, including Senator McConnell, say they don't have a legislative agenda for the midterms and they're not going to share one. And then to his right or to his base or whatever you want to call it, you have MAGA voices openly vowing that if they win back the House, they will literally try to get opponents jailed and opponents impeached no matter what.
I think when you have a Republican Congress, this is all going to come crashing down and the wolves are going to find out that they're now sheep. And they're the ones who are, in fact, going to, I think, face a real risk of jail for the kind of laws they're breaking.
I think there are potentially multiple grounds to consider for impeachment.
Write it down. This November is about one thing. It's impeaching Joe Biden.
What's wild about that is while President Biden has had some setbacks in this first year, we've reported on them, you might think that someone seeking the votes of the public would talk about inflation or COVID or things affecting real people's lives, not saying that their biggest priority is impeaching him or jailing people. This is, in a way, politics unmoored from reality, as the nation faces very real challenges. We want to bring in a special expert who knows not only how this all works, Chairman Michael Steele, who ran the Republican Party, but also is known for straight talk. And so I turn the floor over to you. We just went through why it's tough times and a tough job. But your thoughts, sir?
No, it is a tough time and a tough job. And it's great to be with you, Ari, to have this conversation. If the thing tells you what it is, it shows its true colors, then why do we refuse to accept it? When the former speaker, Republican speaker of the House, tells you that come, you know, next year, Republicans have the House and the Senate, you know, people are going to go to jail from the January 6th commission. If you've got Steve Bannon and others telling you that this election is about one thing and one thing only, the impeachment of Joe Biden. I don't understand how Americans look at that and go, yeah, we want that. We want more of that, because that's what you voted against.
And let me ask you on that, Michael.
Yeah.
Just specifically on that, and then you continue. But just because I like to get your perspective, you've been at these upper echelons. Most people haven't run a national party. Why doesn't that hurt them more by just sounding political? I mean, it would seem to me that if you said, hey, here's the problems with Joe Biden that, as I said, relate back to why it's harder to buy groceries, or COVID didn't go away, they said it would. I mean, that seems like that might resonate more. Why do you think that this is even seen as a good idea to focus on impeaching Biden, as if that's going to help people get the groceries or get over this next wave of Omicron?
Because it's not about people getting their groceries or getting over Omicron. It's about how many clicks and likes and dollars get funneled into accounts. That's what Bannon is doing. That's what the speaker is doing. This funds an underlying operation. You've got, once those ballots are cast, you've got to have the money in place to put the challenges in place. On your way to casting those ballots, you got to have the cash in place to make sure that the people who need to get paid to take care of certain things or certain ends of the business, they're paid. So there's a lot more that goes into this. This is not about, this run-up is not about establishing a narrative around policy. Mitch McConnell's already told us that. We're no. What's the agenda? What are you for? Well, wait and find out. Give us the power, and then we'll let you know. And so, as I've been saying now for the past 6 or 7 months, and I will continue to emphasize this right through November, America, what's your priority here? I get it. There's a lot to be upset at Joe Biden about. There's a lot that they've mishandled politically. But at the end of the day, when you stack up this administration against the previous administration, when you stack up the leadership in the House and the Senate against those who want to grab the power back, compare Jim Jordan to Nancy Pelosi, or compare Mitch McConnell against, Chuck Schumer in terms of what their agenda is. We can have that fight, you and I, Ari, over the policy. But that's not the fight the Republicans are going to bring come January of 2023. It's about retributive policymaking. It's about how we use the system against those who turned us out of power. And that's the big setup for 2024. Because if Trump gets reelected, what do you think his agenda is going to be? Retribution, revenge. And it is about hauling the Biden administration, if not the former president himself, in front of their tribunals to complete the work that they could not get completed on January 6th.
So when you put it like that, it's really not a political process, but one of holding the barricades that the Garland Justice Department really has to, in a nonpartisan way, protect democracy and continue these probes in a way that is both unimpeachable, no pun intended, but also sanctions and punishes what you're talking about, so that next time people don't think that they could do it and get away with it.
Well, that's the key thing. And it's at the crux of all of this. Accountability. When you are no longer held accountable for the things you do, the words you say, the actions you take as an elected official, as someone empowered under our Constitution, an oath that you swore to uphold, if you're not held accountable for your actions, then guess what? You continue to commit those acts. And so we have come to rely, after 240 plus years of jurisprudence in this nation, on a Justice Department and a justice system, as fraught as it is from time to time, that in the end, the underlying foundations of our system are going to be fortified by the prosecution of those who seek to undermine the Constitution and to create disequilibrium, if you will, inside of the balance of power between the branches of government. So all of this is connected. And so, yeah, Ari, we are going to look to the Garland Justice Department to do the right thing, not by some political outcome or not by Joe Biden's agenda, but do the right thing by the American people.
Right.
We witnessed the usurpation of authority the taking down of our, the attempted taking down of our government. So what's the price that you pay for that? Is it just a slap on the wrist? Do you get to defile the importance of a subpoena because you don't want to appear because you think you've got some political, you know, card that you can play to get you out of that legal trouble? Well, you can't look at the country and say that those who perpetrated that act get the free pass, and then look at the brothers and sisters who are now standing in line before their day in court or who just received a subpoena and expect them to adhere to that same justice system and follow those same rules.
Yeah. No, you lay it out, and that's why I wanted to start with you one-on-one. Michael Steele, I want to thank you. And tell everyone what we have coming up because it overlaps with what we were just discussing. I've prepared with our team here a special report on this new revelations about the electors' plot that Trump aides admitted right here on The Beat and some of their new response.
Everything that was done illegally by the Trump legal team.
Yeah. As the legal team, it was our job to make sure that every contingency was covered. Okay. So hence the process that was undertaken.
Yes. All the stuff leading up to 6 January, everything was worked on 100% legal.
It's an important accountability story that will stay on. Also tonight, the politics, Democrats bearing down on Kristen Sinema. And then by the end of the hour, the best-selling novelist James Patterson and Mike Lukapka are back live on The Beat. Stay with us.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Now we turn to tonight's special report, which begins with the attack on American democracy that Donald Trump vowed before the 2020 November election even hit Election Day. In fact, he continued along those lines, digging into an attack on the idea that the results would ever be followed. This was really something that became clear at around 2:30 in the morning, late into election night. Now, there was no formal result at that hour, but he could see the signs. And so right then, he began lying that he won the election, a brazen attempt to override his loss, which then continued as he later put pressure in the states Biden won, demanding some local Republicans try to overrule what their own voters did and to put in fraudulent alternate electors, falsely claiming Trump won.
Frankly, we did win this election. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, Trump has also invited the Republican leaders of the Michigan House and Senate to meet with him at the White House tomorrow, even though both have said they have no plans for any long-shot maneuvers aimed at the Republican legislature naming an alternate set of pro-Trump electors for Michigan. They're trying to just overturn the election and install the president in power.
Fact check. True. So some of that played out in public. It failed, and a failed plot to steal the election may seem less ominous or grave because we know it did fail. But a failed plot to end American democracy is still important. A failed plot that happens in the open but is misunderstood, minimized, and never punished is even more dangerous for next time. So as more evidence about this plot came out, journalists have been bearing down on it. In fact, it happened. Some of this reporting and some of the new revelations have broken on MSNBC, with Rachel Maddow digging into the electors' plot for weeks.
10 Wisconsin Republicans literally forged documents and impersonated electors to make it look like Trump had won their state so they could be substituted as the Wisconsin electors if the January 6 plot worked. Turns out it wasn't just Wisconsin. Here's Republicans in Michigan and Arizona pretending to be their state's electors, pretending to be electors for Trump. They actually created these fake documents purporting to be the real certifications of them as electors. The forged documents all match. This would therefore appear to be some kind of a coordinated effort. Turns out it was Rudy. Rudy Giuliani and associates directly conveyed to Vice President Pence and his staff that Pence should count the fake ones when it came time to tally up the Electoral College results on January 6th. It wasn't one state, wasn't three states where they did this. It was at least five states where we have now obtained forged documents created by Republicans.
The wider coordinated plot is starting to come into view, and it looks even worse. The evidence shows it looks more serious now. It looks like the Trump campaign got closer than many realized at the time. So even as the press and the responsible parts of the American public took the January 6th insurrection quite seriously, the mechanics of that day are still coming into view, with Trump's own aides and lawyers under heat for a playbook they could try to use again. The House January 6th committee is probing all of this, with questions about how high and how coordinated this electors plot was. Was it just random Republicans doing pranks, which, yes, involve illegal forgery, but would still be low level? Or was it led by the Trump campaign, which makes it so much more serious? Well, the recent reporting, as I showed you, is going in that direction. And then if so, who exactly led it? And when you come to reporting on who led it, is it an accusation where people allege Trump aides led this bad thing, but some of them now spin it or deny it? Well, the committee just subpoenaed four top Trump lawyers last week amidst some of these revelations. And this is all the context for one of the first independent press interviews with any of those lawyers since the subpoenas landed. When subpoenaed Trump lawyer Boris Epstein joined me Friday, along with a Trump White House vet and an organizer of the January 6th rally, this was a chance to actually learn new things and get people on the record. Now, there are many types of questions here, but it all starts with the plot to use fraudulent or alternate electors to override the votes in these states that Biden won, which the authorities in the states found he won, which the courts then affirmed. So installing false and fraudulent electors that you call alternates in those states looks like stealing an election and an attempt to do so. Now, under questioning, Epstein admitted he was in on that plot. Did you ever make calls like that regarding what you're calling these alternate electors?
I was quoted in the Washington Post in the last 24 hours. Yes, I was part of the process to make sure there were alternate electors for when, as we hoped, the challenges to the seated electors would be heard and would be successful per the 12th Amendment of the Constitution and the Electoral Count Act.
Epstein admitting a bombshell on live TV. He personally tried to install those electors, which would override the actual lawful votes in that state. Understandably, this is sparking headlines about a lawyer fessing up the plot and, quote, brazenly admitting to the scheme. CNN running with the news under the headline, Trump advisor acknowledges being part of 2020 alternate electors plot. The plan was to abuse partisan power at the state level to steal the election. The failed plan is to commit the ultimate mass voter fraud. And you have to understand how this would work in their minds, which we're learning more about from the evidence. The idea was they would somehow create enough chaos and confusion through these slates of electors who were claiming to override the votes that Biden won in those states, and that they might use that confusion through Congress to then deny the certification of the election, and then use that to somehow keep Trump in office, even though he lost, to end American democracy. Epstein insists they, in their opinion, viewed their plan as a, quote, legal way to overturn the results. But there are many ways this plot could be deemed criminal, from standard forgery and fraud to conspiring to hinder the administration of U.S. law to breaking other election laws. And as a matter of lawyering, Epstein was clear on another point. He He wasn't doing this alone. This was not a solo dolo kind of plot. He said, he told me, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani led it all as he went about all of those offbeat press conferences and spread conspiracy theories.
Everything that was done illegally by the Trump legal team, by according to the rules and under the leadership of Rudy Giuliani. We fought for the truth.
Good to know it was all under Giuliani's leadership from the lawyer who worked alongside him. That's what we call confirmation on the record. That what may become a receipt. It's from an inside player. And it fits into what the other evidence and reporting suggests, because as I mentioned, some of what we know, we only know because of the work of so many journalists, print and other mediums. Giuliani was reportedly the ringleader, trying to overturn the election through electors in seven states, possibly more we don't know about yet. None of this is a drill. What may have looked quite absurd and futile and even not that threatening to democracy in the moment, and what did fail, we are learning, if we pay attention seriously, was actually a more organized plot to combine forgery, lies, and maybe some quasi-legal methods, which is to say it may be true that some of the aspects, while unsavory, would not be technically crimes. But put it all together to try to turn the January 6th ceremonial certification into a procedural bloodbath where there would be fights in our fact-free media landscape on the internet about which electors really were real. And wait, there are these questions. And look at this forged document. Epstein and Bannon were pumping up Pence's supposed power as they went into this process. And even though everyone knew which states Biden won, and we have a process for that with secretaries of state and nonpartisan oversight and the courts, we have to be very clear here. This is why I'm reporting this out for you with the information from other journalists, as well as our own primary reporting here on the beat, as well as our interviews. These lawyers thought if they had enough Trump electors in those Biden states and they stoked enough disinformation, enough questions, enough lies, this would be a tangible step to steal the whole thing with pressure on Vice President Pence to claim Trump won or, short of that, to get him to at least use the electoral mess that they made, the confusion about the electors that is a product of their forgeries, to then try to claim that day that the electors for each state were somehow in legitimate doubt. They weren't, legally or factually, but that would be the maneuver. And remember, people didn't know how Pence would ultimately come down. That's why I mentioned that some of these things look less scary when you know the ending, like watching a scary movie the second time. But this is not a movie, and there were people trying to get this done, and a different official or a different vice president or a future election might roll differently. Because Pence was in on everything Trump ever wanted him to do until January 6th. When he broke with the authoritarian plot. Low bar, and also it'll help keep you out of jail if you don't, you know, try to break election law, but that's when he broke. And as reporters noted at the time, as Rachel recently broadcast, Pence added new text to the usual process there. It all sounds pretty dry and technical, so I'm about to play you just the key part. I want you to listen for where Pence says the parliamentarian advises that the certificate of votes is the only certificate and has the proper authority to appoint these electors. As you listen to this right now, I want you to keep in mind, whether you normally speak Pence's language, this is how in Pence-ese you say, I'm not helping stage a coup through fake electors.
After ascertainment has been had that the certificates are authentic and correct in form, the tellers will announce the votes cast by the electors for each state, beginning with Alabama, which the parliamentarians advise me is the only certificate of vote from that state and purports to be a return from the state that has annexed to it a certificate from an authority of that state.
That was his procedural reference to the electors' plot, best we can tell. Staking part of his apparent pushback on what, quote, the parliamentarian advised him. It stood out then. It stands out more now. And while the Trump lawyers insist that they had plans to submit slates through what they view as proper procedures, and they are entitled to their defense, we want to give you all the facts. Keep in mind that, one, there are laws criminalizing any misuse of authority to interfere with elections. Wonder if Pence's lawyer told him about that. And two, forgery is a separate and pretty clear-cut crime if you have lies in writing submitted to official departments like the government or courts, etc. Three, If investigators were to link any of this to the storming of the Capitol itself, which Epstein did deny to us on Friday, you could have separate exposure for conspiracy. And four, lawyers lose their privilege if they're found to be planning any future crime or fraud, even if someone else is the one doing the potential later crime. So that's a lot. As for the piece about what is indictable, here's Michigan's attorney general on one part of this.
Under state law, I think clearly you have forgery of a public record, which is a 14-year offense, and election law forgery, which is a 5-year offense. This is a matter that is best investigated and potentially prosecuted by the feds.
Both of us have been asked a lot as this has come out, what was legal, what was illegal. And I think it's important to emphasize here that this is all unprecedented.
Best prosecuted by the feds. And tonight we know some authorities have already made an official referral to the Justice Department about this. That's feds. Other probes may be in the works without public confirmation at the state and local level. And there's those open cases I mentioned. When you take it all together, you never know which evidence may be the breakout smoking gun. The gun smokes in its own way, in its own time. What you do when you're trying to find facts, which is the intersection of independent law and any good faith journalism, is you try to go to the sources and the evidence. That's what we try to do around here. That's what Rachel's been doing. That's what these print reporters have been doing. You try to ascertain what the best evidence suggests about the facts. And you always go to the sources if they'll talk. Some will, some won't. If they talk and they make admissions against interests, you listen. Jill Winebanks is here when we're back in 1 minute. We are back with former Watergate prosecutor Jill Winebanks. Thanks for being here. I just walked through some of the evidence we have. Your reaction specifically to the mounting evidence regarding what was a coordinated effort to try to override the votes through the electors in several states.
I think you made a very compelling opening statement to show a conspiracy to interfere with the election, to interfere with a official congressional proceeding, to commit forgery within the federal laws and certainly within each state's laws. You noted that two of the states caveated their forgeries by saying this is only good in the event that the legitimate slate of Democratic electors fails. Then we become the electors. But the other states all said we are the duly elected electors. That is clearly a forgery. And there is a forgery statute not for forging money, which is normally how you think of forgery, but for other government-related documents. And this is clearly a government-related document that could have had a very dramatic impact, because if you were presented with two things that said that they were the official electors and you had to say, well, we'll count this one or this one, how would you know? Well, of course, mm-hmm. we all know because we watch the election returns. We know who won each state. But that doesn't make the attempt any less criminal. It is a crime. And there is nothing about, I mean, your interview with Boris Epstein was amazing. But he can say, we did this all legally. He didn't do it legally. You can't right. create an alternate slate of electors. That is fraud.
Right. And having a plan or a memo or an eventuality is quite different from, as you say, if it meets the test and other independent authorities can deal with that on forgery. There has been reaction to the interview. We're aware of that. Bannon and Epstein have spoken out further. And again, to get at the facts and also fact check, here's some of their new reaction after the interview. Take a look.
All I did was very calmly, methodically walk through the law yeah. as the legal team. It was our job to make sure that every contingency was covered. Okay. So hence the process that was undertaken. Yes. It was said loud and clear on MSNBC that one, President Trump yeah. won the election, two, that it was stolen, and three, a legal case was laid out.
And all the stuff leading up to 6 January, everything was worked on 100% legal.
Jill, that's the latest. Your response?
I'd like to be the lawyer on the other side of arguing that that was not legal. There was no contingency in existence. it was clear who had won the votes in that state. And we have a rule where we count the votes of the people, not the people who want it to be somebody else. But if you vote, your vote gets counted. You vote for an elector, and only that elector can represent you and cast the ballot at the Electoral College. We should amend the Electoral College Act. We should eliminate the Electoral College. We now have ways of communicating that do not require the Electoral College as it was set up in a time when there wasn't the official communication methods that we now have. But even under the laws now, there was nothing legal about what they did. And the elector slates were certified, or ascertained is the official word, were ascertained by each state, signed off by the governor, and sent officially to the Congress to be counted. And then these fraudulent people, and it's also important to note that when you vote, you are voting for an elector who's on the ballot. And some of the people who were on the ballot said, "Oh, that's that. We didn't win. I'm not signing this certificate." So the people in charge of this under Giuliani recruited people who weren't ever even on the ballot. So in addition to signing a fraudulent document, there were fraudulent people on it.
Well, that's an important point you raise, because, again, I mentioned that if this were some hijinks, you know, random people with no campaign involvement, you really would deal with that on the side, like any local forgery. The interstate nature, and as you say, the recruitment of other individuals, legally goes to the intent. I also want to play some of the other parts of the interview, because there's an overlap, as I mentioned, between some of this plot and the larger claims by Trump officials that they could, they claim, legally keep him in power. Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon's so-called Green Bay sweep or coup. Here's a little bit more from what we got on Friday.
Yes, I was part of the process to make sure there were alternate electors for when, as we hoped, the challenges to the seated electors would be heard and would be successful.
My role in what the Washington Post calls the coup, that we call the Green Bay sweep, was simply to look at the analysis of what happened in the election. I started that on Thanksgiving Day of 2020.
I certainly would caution anyone against going to work for a Trump campaign. I'll definitely be looking to support somebody else in the Republican primary.
A range of reactions from people who had different roles, as mentioned, on January 6th. Your thoughts, big picture, not only strictly legal, but as someone who was so involved in dealing with Watergate and its aftermath, about what we're hearing from these people and this moment we're in, where, in fairness, some people seem to be changing a bit, at least when it comes to whether they want to have a working democracy, and others seem to be trying to normalize the very thing that was thwarted.
I would say that they are all brazen in their attempt to justify this, that they are admitting in public their guilt. When I first heard Peter Navarro saying what he said, it was like, well, okay, that's going to be used against you in a court of law because you've admitted your guilt. And all of these people have done things that are wrong, that cannot be justified. The Green Bay sweep reminded me of Operation Gemstone, which was the original basis for the Democratic National Committee break-in that led to the Watergate indictments. It was an absurd and ridiculous plan. It goes along with the PowerPoint that was presented of all the different ways they could interfere with counting the Electoral College votes and delay the vote, or in some way get time to get states to change their mind. That's not how democracy works. And it's very, very distressing. This is much, much, much worse than Watergate. Watergate never threatened our democracy. It did threaten the Department of Justice. It did threaten justice. But ultimately, there were facts that everybody agreed on. Democrats and Republicans and all of the media had one set of facts, and that led to a resignation and to convictions. And that's what needs to happen here, is we somehow have to get back to people accepting what is true, what is fact, and repeating the big lie is all part of the conspiracy to undo our elections, and that's wrong.
Jill Weinbanks, with the final word in this program, on the big issue with a lot of experience to back up your views here on law and corruption in America. Thank you very much. We have a quick break, but coming up, the new pressure on Senator Sinema and why liberals say they have a solution. And later, what's better than one best-selling author? Two, Patterson and Lubica are here. Stay with us.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Democratic Senator Kristen Sinema is facing a backlash for helping Republicans keep the filibuster alive instead of having a loophole to at least protect voting rights. Party leaders in Arizona now uniting to censure her after she and Manchin were the only Democrats to side with Republicans to keep the filibuster in all cases, not providing any exception for voting rights. Senator Sanders says they should also face primaries.
I think what the Arizona Democratic Party did was exactly right. If there were strong candidates in those states who were prepared to stand up for working families, who understand that the Democratic Party has got to be the party of working people taking on big money interests, if those candidates were there in Arizona and West Virginia, yes, I would be happy to support them.
Signs of some change, perhaps, on the center left or left. And we're joined by Joan Walsh, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation and a friend of the beat. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ari. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I think viewers are very familiar with the tendency for more challenges in primaries and more types of heavy pressure campaigns on the right than the left. Do you see this as something new and possibly productive if it is used well by the left?
Using it well is really the question. I don't know that I think a primary of Joe Manchin is a good idea. He's had several primary challengers. They don't do well. It's a very red state. Arizona is totally different. I totally believe that Kyrsten Sinema could lose a Democratic primary in Arizona. And I hope she gets a challenger. But, you know, part of me doesn't know if she even cares, Ari. I think that the number one thing I can say about her, I don't know what's at her core, but she seems like a classic narcissist to me. She's loving this attention. She doesn't care what you and I say about her. She doesn't care about what the activists are saying about her. I'm not even sure she intends to run again. She's got all this pharmaceutical money, all this financial industry money. She could have a great career in either industry and make a literal fortune. So I'm not sure we're scaring her with these threats, but I certainly hope somebody steps up to run against her if she runs.
Interesting point. And you're sort of distinguishing the lumping or the emotional ways that people might look at those two senators together and say, well, you have to look at the underlying facts. As for her standing in the Democratic Party, she took what was basically a generalized support. We have the numbers here. I mean, 60% in 2020, 67% in 21. That's pretty good in your own party when you're new and you're not. She doesn't have 100% name ID. It's plummeted to be one of the biggest drops in recent era of anyone in any party for any reason, Joan, to 8% of her own party supporting her.
Well, I think she did that to herself, obviously, Ari. I mean, you know, she really came to national attention when she voted against the minimum wage, which she used to support. But she did it, you know, wearing her jaunty outfit, doing a little curtsy in the well and giving a big thumbs down. She wanted that negative attention. She wanted attention. She's gotten some positive attention from Republicans. They all lined up to shake her hand the other day when she killed voting rights by not changing Senate rules. She likes that attention. She likes the money. I don't think it matters to her what the activists, the people that I know in Arizona who gave her money, who, you know, walked precincts for her, they're furious. But I think she's turned her sights to a whole different set of folks. And we'll see what she does and how it turns out for her.
Copy. Was curious where you came down on that, because the censure and the pressure is all news breaking over this weekend. Joan Walsh, I want to thank you. And we've got two authors standing by. It's Patterson and Lupica, Together on the Beat, next. There's a lot of different things going on these days, but did you know that almost 35 million people watched that Kansas Chiefs-Buffalo Bills game in a total roller coaster? It was Sunday's largest television audience by several orders of magnitude. It's a reminder of the way that sports still captivates our weary and polarized nation, even in a modern world where you could literally watch just about anything from any time, anywhere on your screens and phones. People come together for football and sports. And that brings us to something a little different to end tonight's show, at least our last interview segment, which is two best-selling authors have teamed up for a book that digs into why people care about these things, these matters, these sports, James Patterson and Mike Lupica. The book is The Horsewoman, a novel about a mother and daughter equestrians. Thanks to both of you for being here. James, we had you back earlier and talked about a lot of different stuff because you've had quite a life. As you know, people always ask me why so many stories about equestrians on the news. It's like every night I do this, you know?
Well, you know, football, great athletes, and we transition right into the great athletes in this story, which are horses, and then the mother and daughter who compete to go to the Olympics. And just a suspense of this is one of these sports, like when you watch gymnastics in the Olympics, one mistake and you're out. You know, 4 years of training and it's down the drain, just like the Buffalo Bills went down last night.
So let's get into it, because as I say, I joke about the horse part, but the sports part's so real. What is it about the mixture of competition, what you just said, the desired or required precision, and the relationships here, these women who are so talented and forging this bond?
Mike?
Well, we've got two horses, two women, but one goal, to make it to the Paris Olympics. And these horses become characters. Ari, they become characters in this book. I mean, my daughter has been doing this since she was 10 years old. And you can give the horse the greatest ride in the world. And if you catch one rail, you're out. And so there's that tension you get in gymnastics, or watching a figure skater try to make a landing, knowing that if she doesn't stick the landing, that she blows her chance at a gold medal. And what we really tried to do in this book, seriously, was put you on that horse and in that ring in a sport where teenagers compete against women in their 60s, men compete against women. We love the sport.
Yeah, and every book that I do, whether it's Alex Cross or this, I want the emotion of those main characters, and you get it with Maggie and Becky. And then the suspense, who's going to get to the Olympics? And people will root for, you know, mother-daughter. There's now mother-daughter book clubs about this book. And some favor Maggie and some favor Becky. And will either one of them win? And then just as we both said, the suspense of the contest themselves.
Yeah. I got another question that's kind of weird. Now, if I ask you, James, are you going to punt it over to Mike?
I don't know. We'll see. Throw it out there. It won't be a punt. It'll be like a pass. You know, it'll be like,
fair.
Yeah, quarterback or for the moment.
Hey, you guys know a lot of sports better than I do, but that sounds correct, that it would be more like an assist than a punt. It wouldn't be going to a different team. I digress. The question is this. How does this set of relationships also relate to the way that people can bond so much with an animal. The way that people feel this is competitive or sports context, but people feel this with pets, grieving a pet's loss can really be serious. Walk us through where that relationship fits into the story.
Absolutely. The relationships of these riders, the mother and daughter, and they each have their own horse, is incredibly strong. And the horse has a strong relation, unlike, you know, with thoroughbred racing, where all of a sudden the jockey comes on and it might not even be somebody that they've who's ridden before. In this case, the horse and this rider, they've been riding together for years.
Mike, same question, but is it any different with horses than, say, other pets or other things that people relate to of animals in their households?
Yeah, they're a lot bigger. And they're a lot bigger, Ari. And
more expensive, right, Mike?
Yeah, Ari, that's another thing. It was time for this sport to give back to me because my daughter's been doing
I bet you've
since
spent something.
Then. But no, we have a scene where the horse falls on one of the riders in our story. I won't tell you which one, but it informs the whole rest of the book. And I spoke to some riders. I said, "What's that like?" And they said, "It's like the sky fell on you." That's an element.
Mike doesn't have much of an imagination. He can't imagine what it would be like for a horse to fall on him.
Well, I like to be. I like to be accurate. I mean,
That's what happens when you get a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer together. It's great.
Well, that takes me where I wanted to go next. First of all, you guys clearly have a rapport. I get the feeling you enjoyed writing the book together. But I got to ask James Pattison, you know, we know Lupica for years and viewers know him and people in sports and politics know him. I think that's a fair statement. So we feel like we really know him. But how does he compare as a co-author to other people you've had? You famously wrote with Bill Clinton himself
President
and others. How
Clinton,
does Lupica
and
compare?
We have a Dolly Parton coming in March. Now, I tell you what, Mike is the best writer I've ever worked with.
He
and President Clinton are both good-looking guys. You know what we'll do is we almost can complete each other's thoughts now, and this worked in the book. We would go back and forth like I start to think.
And then I sink.
Into the paper.
Like I was ink. Maybe that wasn't exactly our original writing. That might be.
It might have been
Rakim, the guy MC. But we just wanted you to get a sense of how
we like Nicki Minaj and we like Megan Thee Stallion. What gets us back to horses?
I love it. I love that it was thought out and prepared. I was thinking Andre 3000 when he says he wants a simple life, and then he says, "Well, I also want a horse and a Porsche and bullets that scorch." And of course, the Porsche is also the horse logo of the Porsche. So I was thinking horse literally, but you guys took it there. I love it.
We took another place.
Jim, I told you.
You know,
Jim,
I tell you what, I think Eric could fit with us. We could be a threesome next book. What do you think?
Yeah,
Ari,
shout out to
I
the.
Told him,
yep.
I told
politics
him that
as a sport, America's favorite sport, politics.
No. That's fair too. You guys have too much fun. Now I gotta wrap it, but I love a shout out to Rakim. I love that you probably know Black on Both Sides, Mohsen Talib also quote that same line. Culture is an echo. I appreciate you guys, James and Mike, and let me shout it out again. The book, The Horsewoman, is out now.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.